coffee, and it's not really representative of the financial pressure that that is on most people. But there it is. Wow. Bill O'Reilly. Fascinating, fascinating stuff there. We have a voicemail number. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here's a question about 2024.
Hey, David, my name is Steve. I'm calling from San Diego, California.
Please.
I just wanted to drop my 2 cents on who's better, DeSantis or Trump?
Right.
Or who's worse, I guess. I think it's Trump. I think DeSantis, obviously, like you say, he probably could do more damage policy-wise just because he's not so crazy.
Yes.
But he, I think Trump would do more damage to our institutions long-term and short-term, just destroying democracy. I just can't understand, or I can't fathom seeing Trump in office without the possibility of him looking forward to having an answer to the voters again.
Yeah, I understand the point that the caller is making, but I actually still think that by virtue of being less cartoonishly unable to get anything done, in the net, DeSantis would be worse than Trump. I still think that, but I'm open to having my mind changed. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. We'll talk about the Twitter Elon Musk deal evaporating. We'll talk about California starting to make its own insulin. And we will talk about the euro dollar parity that has been reached for the first time in 20 years. And I have no plans to take advantage of it. That's for sure. Sign up at joinpacman.
WRCT, in sound from way out.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best. The smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940. my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
American carnage. That's Donald Trump's true legacy. His desire to overthrow the people's election and seize the presidency interrupted the counting of Electoral College votes for the first time in American history, nearly toppled the constitutional order, and brutalized hundreds and hundreds of people. The Watergate break-in was like a Cub Scout meeting compared to this assault on our people and our institutions.
In its seventh public hearing, the U.S. House Select Committee to investigate the January 6 attack on the United States Capitol focuses on connections between former President Donald Trump and domestic extremist groups that carried out the deadly assault. We'll hear highlights from the hearing, including how Trump sent his call to arms tweet for extremist groups to come to the Capitol January 6 after an unhinged meeting in the White House between his formal and informal advisors. The committee also heard live testimony from a man who participated in the riot and a former spokesperson for the far-right Oath Keepers.
I do fear for this next election cycle, because who knows what that might bring. If a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage, to whip up a civil war amongst his followers using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact, what else is he going to do if he gets elected again?
We'll also hear some of the newest evidence presented Tuesday from Friday's video deposition of former White House counsel Pat Cipollone. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol has revealed stark new details tying former President Trump to the most violent extremists leading the insurrection. During a public hearing Tuesday, the committee heard live testimony from a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers militia group, Jason Van Tatenhoff.
I think we need to quit mincing words and just talk about truths. And what it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there.
Some of the newest evidence presented Tuesday came from the recent video deposition of former White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who described heated arguments in the West Wing over Trump's attempts to find a pathway to remain in power. After headlines, we'll spend the rest of the hour airing highlights from Tuesday's hearing. Sri Lanka's embattled president has fled the country aboard a military jet following massive protests against official corruption, nepotism, and the economic crisis. Sri Lanka's Air Force said President Gotabaya Rajapaksa flew to the Maldives with his wife. Officials there said he would not remain in the Maldives and would transit to a third country. It's not clear which country might accept him. On Tuesday, the Indian newspaper The Hindu reported the United States rejected Rajapaksa's request for a U.S. visa. As one of his final acts, Rajapaksa appointed his hand-picked Prime Minister, Ranil Wickremesinghe, as Sri Lanka's acting president. His office said he would call a nationwide state of emergency and impose a curfew in the capital, Colombo, where thousands of people continue to protest. President Biden's arrived in Jerusalem for talks with Israeli officials, the first stop on a four-day Mideast trip that will take him to the West Bank and to Saudi Arabia, where he'll meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Ahead of Biden's departure, the family of Shireen Abu Akleh demanded Biden call out Israel over the killing of the Palestinian-American journalist who was shot dead by Israel's military in May while covering a raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. In a letter to President Biden, the family wrote, quote, "Your administration's actions can only be seen as an attempt to erase the extrajudicial killing of Shireen and further entrench the systemic impunity enjoyed by Israeli forces and officials for unlawfully killing Palestinians," they wrote. A warning to our audience, the next headline contains disturbing footage and descriptions of gun violence. In Texas, the Austin American Statesman has published video of the May 24th massacre at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde. The video corroborates earlier press accounts that law enforcement officers, many of them with ballistic shields and powerful weapons, waited in the school's hallway for well over an hour before a team finally confronted the gunman and shot him dead. At Tuesday's meeting at the Uvalde City Council, Mayor Don McLaughlin blasted news outlets for releasing the video. He and other city council members said families should have had a chance to view the footage before its public release.
The way that video was released today is one of the most chicken things I've ever seen.
The mayor said chicken. It was chicken.
Yeah.
To release that video the way you did it.
What about the cops? Are they chicken?
We're going to handle that.
He said that they did a good job. You still think they did a good job?
Adam, I'm not going to get into an argument with you on that deal. I haven't seen the video yet.
Confronting Mayor McLaughlin was Adam Martinez, whose 8-year-old son was inside Robb Elementary School during the shooting. Martinez blasted the mayor for failing to criticize the police response.
Everybody else, the whole world knows that they're chicken. But it won't come out of his mouth for whatever reason. He's lying to himself. And we need to see that he holds them accountable. He needs to be seeing the same thing that we're seeing. Otherwise, we're not going to be on the same side.
In Arizona, Republican Governor Doug Ducey has signed a new state law making it illegal to knowingly film a police officer at a distance of 8 feet or closer unless the officer grants permission. The law also allows officers to order people to stop recording if they're on private property and police have the owner's consent. In response, media outlets across the United States signed on to a letter from the National Press Photographers Association that read in part, quote, "We are extremely concerned that this language violates not only the free speech and press clauses of the First Amendment, but also runs counter to the clearly established right to photograph and record police officers performing their official duties in a public place," unquote. A federal judge has blocked the enforcement of an Arizona statute classifying fetuses, embryos, and fertilized eggs as people, which would have criminalized abortion across the state. This comes as Arizonans brace for the imminent activation of a 15-week abortion ban that Republican Governor Doug Ducey signed into law in March. Meanwhile, a state judge in Louisiana has temporarily blocked the state's trigger abortion bans from taking effect for the second time. The decision is the latest in a series of back-and-forths to the legal status of abortion in Texas. One of Louisiana's few remaining abortion clinics said it would resume providing abortion care. In Ukraine, officials in the Russian-occupied town of Novokakhovka said a Ukrainian missile attack killed 7 people and wounded dozens of others Tuesday. Russia says the strikes hit a fertilizer plant, leading to a huge explosion. Ukraine says it destroyed a Russian ammunition depot. Officials on both sides attributed the attack to a HIMARS missile system recently supplied to Ukraine by the United States. This comes as Ukraine's military says Russia's massing for a new offensive, seeking to capture more territory in the eastern Donetsk province. Elsewhere, military delegations from Ukraine and Russia are meeting with United Nations officials in Istanbul, Turkey today to discuss a deal to allow safe passage of ships carrying food and other supplies from Ukraine's Black Sea port of Odessa. In Europe, the Nord Stream 1 pipeline has been shut down for 10 days of maintenance, cutting off the flow of natural gas from Russia to Germany and other EU nations. The cutoff was planned, though it's not clear whether Russian officials will restart gas shipments later this month when the pipeline is scheduled to come back online. 140 days after Russia invaded Ukraine, Germany still relies on Russia for more than a third of its gas supply, while France imports about 17% of its gas from Russia. The United Nations Security Council has voted to extend life-saving humanitarian aid to millions in northern Syria for another 6 months. The resolution put forward by Ireland and Norway originally called for a year-long extension to shipments of food, medicine, and shelter for the rebel-held area. but was cut down to 6 months after days of Russian opposition. In other news from Syria, the Pentagon announced Tuesday it assassinated a senior leader of the Islamic State, Mar al-Agha, in a drone strike. The BBC reports British commandos deployed to Afghanistan killed at least 54 Afghans under suspicious circumstances during a six-month tour of Helmand province starting in late 2010. The investigation found a pattern in which unarmed people were routinely shot dead, with weapons later planted on them to justify the crimes. The BBC also documented bullet holes at several homes that suggested execution-style killings rather than firefights. In response, the UK Ministry of Defense accused the BBC of irresponsible, incorrect journalism. President Trump's former national security adviser, John Bolton, said Tuesday he'd helped plan attempted coups in foreign countries. Bolton made the remark to CNN's Jake Tapper as the pair discussed the Capitol insurrection and whether former President Trump was able to effectively plan a coup d'etat.
One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah,
not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work.
In 2004, when John Bolton was with the State Department, he reportedly backed the coup in Haiti that removed the democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Bolton also pushed for regime change during the U.S. occupation of Iraq, and in 2018 said the U.S. should overthrow the government of Iran. And NASA has released the first images from its new flagship telescope, the JWST, revealing an unprecedented view of the cosmos, from galaxies that formed just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang to the births of stars and vast nebulas of gas and dust. The telescope is named after James Webb, who served as NASA administrator during the era of the Apollo moon landings. Earlier this year, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson rejected a petition signed by over 1,200 astronomers and astrophysicists demanding a change to the telescope's name amidst new revelations about how Webb helped to purge NASA of LGBTQ+ employees as part of federal policy. The petition reads in part, quote, "The historical record is already clear. Under Webb's leadership, queer people were persecuted. Those who would excuse Webb's failure of leadership cannot simultaneously award him credit for his management of Apollo," they said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol revealed stark new details at its seventh public hearing Tuesday, focusing on evidence that shows the connections between former President Donald Trump and extremist groups that carried out the deadly assault. The committee also heard live testimony from a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers and from a man who said he participated in the riot at the Capitol because Trump told supporters to go there. In a dramatic scene after the hearing, the rioter, Stephen Ayers, shook hands and apologized to officers who defended the Capitol. Some of the newest evidence presented Tuesday came from the deposition of former White House counsel Pat Cipollone, which just happened on Friday. Today, we'll bring you highlights from the hearing. This is committee vice chair, Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, in her opening remarks.
Our committee did not conduct a hearing last week, but we did conduct an on-the-record interview of President Trump's former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. If you have watched these hearings, you've heard us call for Mr. Cipollone to come forward to testify. He did, and Mr. Cipollone's testimony met our expectations. We will save for our next hearing President Trump's behavior during the violence of January 6th. Today's hearing will take us from December 14th, 2020, when the Electoral College met and certified the results of the 2020 presidential election, up through the morning of January 6th. You will see certain segments of Pat Cipollone's testimony today. We will also see today how President Trump summoned a mob to Washington and how the president's stolen election lies provoked that mob to attack the Capitol. And we will hear from a man who was induced by President Trump's lies to come to Washington and join the mob, and how that decision has changed his life. Today's hearing is our seventh. We have covered significant ground over the past several weeks, And we have also seen a change in how witnesses and lawyers in the Trump orbit approach this committee. Initially, their strategy in some cases appeared to be to deny and delay. Today, there appears to be a general recognition that the committee has established key facts, including that virtually everyone close to President Trump, his Justice Department officials, his White House advisors, his White House counsel, his campaign, all told him the 2020 election was not stolen. This appears to have changed the strategy for defending Donald Trump. Now the argument seems to be that President Trump was manipulated by others outside the administration, that he was persuaded to ignore his closest advisors, and that he was incapable of telling right from wrong. This new strategy is to try to blame only John Eastman or Sidney Powell or Congressman Scott Perry or others and not President Trump. In this version, the president was, quote, poorly served by these outside advisors. The strategy is to blame people his advisors called, quote, the crazies for what Donald Trump did. This, of course, is nonsense. President Trump is a 76-year-old man. He is not an impressionable child. Just like everyone else in our country, he is responsible for his own actions and his own choices. As our investigation has shown, Donald Trump had access to more detailed and specific information showing that the election was not actually stolen than almost any other American. And he was told this over and over again. No rational or sane man in his position could disregard that information and reach the opposite conclusion. And Donald Trump cannot escape responsibility by being willfully blind. Nor can any argument of any kind excuse President Trump's behavior during the violent attack on January 6th. As you watch our hearing today, I would urge you to keep your eye on two specific points. First, you will see evidence that Trump's legal team, led by Rudy Giuliani, knew that they lacked actual evidence of widespread fraud sufficient to prove that the election was actually stolen. They knew it, but they went ahead with January 6th anyway. And second, consider how millions of Americans were persuaded to believe what Donald Trump's closest advisors in his administration did not. These Americans did not have access to the truth like Donald Trump did. They put their faith and their trust in Donald Trump. They wanted to believe in him. They wanted to fight for their country, and he deceived them. For millions of Americans, that may be painful to accept, but it is true.
Those are the opening remarks from Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, vice chair of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol at the 7th public hearing Tuesday. Stay with us. By Tears for Fears. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A major focus of Tuesday's hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol was a tweet that was sent by then-President Trump on December 19, 2020. In the tweet, Trump called for a big protest at the coming joint session of Congress on January 6th and told his supporters, "Be there, we'll be wild." Trump sent the tweet one day after a tense meeting at the White House between his official and unofficial advisors that was described in testimony as unhinged. Committee member Jamie Raskin laid out in detail how the meeting unfolded and how the tweet ultimately led some of Trump's most extreme and violent supporters to attack the Capitol. Raskin featured excerpts of video deposition testimony from Trump lawyer Sidney Powell, White House lawyer Eric Hirschman, and White House counsel Pat Cipollone, among others. This is Congressmember Raskin.
So let's return to that meeting at the White House on the evening of December 18. That night, a group showed up at the White House, including Sidney Powell, retired Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, and former Overstock.com CEO Patrick Byrne. After gaining access to the building from a junior White House staffer, the group made their way to the Oval Office. They were able to speak with the president by himself for some time until White House officials learned of the meeting. What ensued was a heated and profane clash between this group and President Trump's White House advisors, who traded personal insults, accusations of disloyalty to the president, and even challenges to physically fight. The meeting would last over 6 hours, beginning here in the Oval Office, moving around the West Wing, and many hours later, ending up in the president's private residence. The Select Committee has spoken with six of the participants, as well as staffers who could hear the screaming from outside the Oval Office. What took place next is best told in their own words, as you will see from this video.
Did you believe that it was going to work, that you were going to be able to get to see the president without an appointment?
I had no idea.
In fact, you did get to see the president without an appointment.
We did.
How much time did you have alone with the president? And I say alone, you had other people with you, but
right.
From his aides before the crowd came running?
Probably no more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Was in that...
I bet Pat Cipollone set a new land speed record.
I got a call either from Molly or Hirschman that I need to get to the Oval Office.
So that was the first point that I had recognized, okay, there was nobody in there from the White House. Mark's gone. What's going on right now?
I opened the door and I walked in. I saw General Flynn. I saw Sidney Powell sitting there. I was not happy to see the people in the Oval Office.
Explain why.
Well, again, I don't think they were providing. Well, first of all, the Overstock person, I've never knew who this guy was. Actually, the first thing I did, I walked in, I looked at him, and I said, "Who are you?" And he told me, "I don't think any of these people were providing the president with good advice." And so I didn't understand how they had gotten in.
In the short period of time that you had with the president, did he seem receptive to the presentation that you were making?
He was very interested in hearing particularly about the CISA finding and the terms of 13848 that apparently nobody else had bothered to inform him of.
That's Sidney Powell.
I was asking, like, you claim the Democrats were working with Hugo Chavez, Venezuelans, and whomever else. And at one point, General Flynn took out a diagram that supposedly showed IP addresses all over the world and ISP, who was communicating with whom via the machines, and some comment about like Nest thermostats being hooked up to the internet.
That was
so it's been reported that during this meeting, Ms. Powell talked about Dominion voting machines and made various election fraud claims that involve foreign countries such as Venezuela, Iran, and China. Is that accurate?
Sure.
Was the meeting tense?
Oh, yeah. It was not a casual meeting.
That was Derek Lyons, White House.
Explain. Aide.
I mean, at times there were people shouting at each other, hurling insults at each other. It wasn't just sort of people sitting around on a couch, like, chit-chatting.
Do you recall whether he raised to Ms. Powell the fact that she and the campaign had lost all of the 60 cases that they had brought in litigation?
That's
yes,
a
he raised that.
And what was the response?
I don't remember what she said. I don't think it was a good response.
Cipollone and Hirschman and whoever the other guy was showed nothing but contempt and disdain of the president.
Yeah, I remember the three of them were really sort of forcefully attacking me verbally. Eric, Derek, and we were pushing back and we were asking one simple question.
Again, that's simple.
As a general matter, where is the evidence? So,
what response did you get when you asked Ms. Powell and her colleagues where's the
evidence? A variety of responses based on my current recollection, including, you know, can't believe you would say something, you know, things like this, like, what do you mean, where's the evidence? You should know, you know, and things like that, or, you know, a disregard, I would say, a general disregard for the importance of actually backing up what you say with facts.
And, you know, then there was discussion of, well, you know, we don't have it now, but we will have it or whatever.
I mean, if it had been me sitting in his chair, I would have fired all of them that night and had them escorted out of the building.
But Derek and I both challenged what she was saying. And she says, well, the judges are corrupt. And I was like, everyone, every single case that you've done in the country you guys lost, every one of them is corrupt, even the ones we appointed. And
what?
I'm being nice. I was much more harsh to her.
So one of the other things that's been reported that was said during this meeting was that President Trump told White House lawyers, Mr. Hirschman and Mr. Cipollone, that they weren't offering him any solutions, but Ms. Powell and others were. So why not try what Ms. Powell and others were proposing? Do you remember anything along those lines being said by President Trump?
I do. That sounds right.
I think that it got to the point where the screaming was completely, completely out there. I mean, you got people walk in, it was late at night, it had been a long day, and what they were proposing, I thought was nuts.
I'm gonna categorically describe it as, you guys are not tough enough. Or maybe I put it another way, you're a bunch of pussies. Excuse the expression, but I'm almost certain the word was used.
Flynn screamed at me that I was a quitter and everything, kept on standing up and turning around and screaming at me. And then at a certain point, I had it with him. So I yelled back, either come over or sit your effing ass back down.
The president and the White House team went upstairs to the residence, but to the
this is Rudolph Giuliani.
Public part of the residence, you know, the big parlor where you can have meetings in the conference room.
Oval. They call that the yellow oval?
Yes, exactly, the yellow oval office. I always called it the upper. And I'm not exactly sure where the Sydney group went. I think maybe the Roosevelt room. And I stayed in the cabinet room, which is kind of cool. I really like that. All by myself.
At the end of the day, we landed where we started the meeting, at least from a structural standpoint, which was Sidney Powell was fighting, Mike Flynn was fighting. They were looking for avenues that would enable, that would result in President Trump remaining President Trump for a second term.
The meeting finally ended after midnight. Here are text messages sent by Cassidy Hutchinson during and after the meeting. As you can see, Ms. Hutchinson reported that the meeting in the West Wing was unhinged. The meeting finally broke up after midnight during the early morning of December 19. Cassidy Hutchinson captured the moment of Mark Meadows escorting Rudy Giuliani off the White House grounds to, quote, make sure he didn't wander back into the mansion. Certain accounts of this meeting indicate that President Trump actually granted Ms. Powell security clearance and appointed her to a somewhat ill-defined position of special counsel.
He asked Pat Cipollone if he had the authority to name me special counsel, and he said yes. And then he asked him if he had the authority to give me whatever security clearance I needed, and Pat Cipollone said yes. And then the president said, okay, you know, I'm naming her that, and I'm giving her security clearance. And then shortly before we left and it totally blew up was when Cipollone and or Hirschman and whoever the other young man was said, you can name her whatever you want to name her, and no one's going to pay any attention to it.
How did he respond? How did the president respond to that?
something like, you see what I deal with, I deal with this all the time.
Over the ensuing days, no further steps were taken to appoint Sidney Powell, but there is some ambiguity about what the president actually said and did during the meeting. Here is how Pat Cipollone described it.
I don't know what her understanding of whether she had been appointed, what she had been appointed to. Okay. In my view, she hadn't been appointed to anything and ultimately wasn't appointed to anything because there had to be other steps taken. So that was my view when I left the meeting, but she may have a different view and others may have a different view, and the president may have a different view.
Were any steps taken, including the president himself telling her she'd been appointed?
Again, I'm not going to get into what the president said in the meeting. My recollection is you're not appointed, even you're not appointed until steps are taken to get the paperwork done. And when I left the meeting, okay, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not going to get into what the president said or said he wanted.
Mr. Cipollone, when the matter continued to flare up over the next several days, was it your understanding that Sidney Powell was still seeking an appointment or that she was asserting that she had been appointed by the president at the December 18 meeting?
You know, now that you mention it, probably both. You know, in terms of, like, I think she may have been of the view that she had been appointed and was seeking to, you know, get that done, and that she should be appointed.
As you listen to these clips, remember that Ms. Powell, the person who President Trump tried to make special counsel, was ultimately sanctioned by a federal court and sued by Dominion Voting Systems for defamation. In her own defense to that lawsuit, Sidney Powell argued that, quote, no reasonable person would conclude that the statements were truly statements of fact. Not long after Sidney Powell, General Flynn, and Rudy Giuliani left the White House in the early hours of the morning, President Trump turned away from both his outside advisors' most outlandish and unworkable schemes and his White House counsel's advice to swallow hard and accept the reality of his loss. Instead, Donald Trump issued a tweet that would galvanize his followers, unleash a political firestorm, and change the course of our history as a country. Trump's purpose was to mobilize a crowd. And how do you mobilize a crowd in 2020? With millions of followers on Twitter, President Trump knew exactly how to do it. At 1:42 a.m. on December 19, 2020, shortly after the last participants left the unhinged meeting, Trump sent out the tweet with his explosive invitation. Trump repeated his big lie and claimed it was, quote, statistically impossible to have lost the 2020 election, before calling for a big protest in D.C. on January 6th. Be there, we'll be wild. Trump supporters responded immediately. Women for America First, a pro-Trump organizing group, had previously applied for a rally permit for January 22nd and 23rd in Washington, D.C., several days after Joe Biden was to be inaugurated. But in the hours after the tweet, they moved their permit to January 6th, 2 weeks before. This rescheduling created the rally where Trump would eventually speak. The next day, Ali Alexander, leader of the Stop the Steal organization and a key mobilizer of Trump supporters, registered wildprotest.com, named after Trump's tweet. Wildprotest.com provided comprehensive information about numerous newly organized protest events in Washington. It included event times, places, speakers, and details on transportation to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, other key Trump supporters, including far-right media personalities, began promoting the wild protest on January 6th.
It's Saturday, December 19th. The year is 2020. And one of the most historic events in American history has just taken place.
That's Alex Jones.
President Trump, in the early morning hours today, tweeted that he wants the American people to march on Washington, D.C. on January 6, 2021.
And now Donald Trump is calling on his supporters to descend on Washington, D.C. January 6th.
He is now calling on we, the people, to take action and to show our numbers.
We're going to only be saved by millions of Americans moving to Washington, occupying the entire area, if necessary, storming right into the Capitol. You know, there we know the rules of engagement. If you have enough people, you can push down any kind of a fence or a wall.
This could be Trump's last stand. And it's a time when he has specifically called on his supporters to arrive in D.C. That's something that may actually be the big push Trump supporters need to say. This is it. It's now or never.
You better understand something, son. You better understand something. Red wave, bitch. Red wave. This is going to be a red wedding going down January 6th.
On that day, Trump says, show up for a protest. It's going to be wild. And based on what we've already seen from the previous events, I think Trump is absolutely correct.
Motherfucker, side. You better look out January 6th. Kick that door open. Look down the street. There's going to be a million plus geeked up armed Americans.
The time for games is over. The time for action is now. Where were you when history called? Where were you when you and your children's destiny and future was on the line?
In that clip, you heard one of Trump's supporters predict a red wedding, which is a pop culture reference to mass slaughter. But the point is that Trump's call to Washington reverberated powerfully and pervasively online. The committee has interviewed a former Twitter employee who explained the effect that Trump had on the Twitter platform. This employee was on the team responsible for platform and content moderation policies on Twitter throughout 2020 and 2021. The employee testified that Twitter considered adopting a stricter content moderation policy after President Trump told the Proud Boys to stand back and stand by from the lectern at the September 29th presidential debate. But Twitter chose not to act. Here's the former employee, whose voice has been obscured to protect their identity, discussing Trump's stand back and stand by comment and the effect it had.
My concern was that the former president, for seemingly the first time, was speaking directly to extremist organizations and giving them directives. We had not seen that sort of direct communication before. And that concerned me.
So just to clarify further, you were worried, and others on Twitter were worried, that the president might use your platform to speak directly to folks who might be incited to violence?
I believe that Twitter relished in the knowledge that they were also the favorite and most used service of the former president, and enjoyed having that sort of power within the social media ecosystem.
If President Trump were anyone else, would it have taken until January 8th, 2021 for him to be suspended?
Absolutely not. If the former president Donald Trump were any other user on Twitter, he would have been permanently suspended a very long time ago.
Despite these grave concerns, Trump remained on the platform completely unchecked. Then came the December 19 tweet and everything it inspired. Indeed.
It felt as if a mob was being organized, and they were gathering together their weaponry and their logic and their reasonings behind why they were prepared to fight prior to December 19th. Again, it was vague. It was non-specific, but very clear that individuals were ready, willing, and able to take up arms. After this tweet on December 19th, again, it became clear not only were these individuals ready and willing, but the leader of their cause was asking them to join him in this cause and in fighting for this cause in DC on January 6th as well. I will also say what shocked me was the responses to these tweets, right? So these were a lot of the locked and loaded, stand back, stand by, those tweets were in response to Donald Trump saying things like this, right? So there would be a response that said, big protests in DC on January 6th, be there, be wild, and someone would respond and say, I'm locked and loaded and ready for Civil War Part 2, right? I very much believe that Donald Trump posting this tweet on December 19th was essentially staking a flag in DC on January 6th for his supporters to come and rally.
And you were concerned about the potential for this gathering becoming violent?
Absolutely.
Indeed, many of Trump's followers took to social media to declare that they were ready to answer Trump's call. One user asked, is the 6th D-Day? Is that why Trump wants everyone there? Another asserted, Trump just told us all to come armed. F***ing A, this is happening. A third took it even further. It will be wild means we need volunteers for the firing squad. Jim Watkins, the owner of 8kun, the fringe online forum that was birthplace of the QAnon extremist movement, confirmed the importance of Trump's tweet.
When did you first decide to go to D.C. for January 6th?
When the President of the United States announced that he was going to have a rally, then I bought ticket and went.
Watkins was at the Capitol on January 6th. Some who have since been indicted for their involvement in the attack on the Capitol also responded. One of them posted on the 19th, quote, calling all patriots, be in Washington, D.C., January the 6th. This wasn't organized by any group. DJT has invited us, and it's going to be wild. Some of the online rhetoric turned openly homicidal and white nationalist, such as, why don't we just kill them, every last Democrat, down to the last man, woman, and child? And it's time for the day of the rope. White revolution is the only solution. Others realized that police would be standing in the way of their effort to overturn the election. So one wrote, I'm ready to die for my beliefs. Are you ready to die, police? Another wrote on the Donald.win, cops don't have standing if they're laying on the ground in a pool of their own blood. The Donald.win was an openly racist and anti-Semitic forum. The Select Committee deposed that site's founder, Jody Williams. He confirmed how the president's tweet created a laser-like focus on the date of January the 6th.
I mean, people have been talking about going to D.C. as soon as the election was over.
And do you recall whether or not the conversation around those dates centered on the 6th after the president's tweet?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, after it was announced that, you know, he was going to be there on the 6th to talk. Yes. Then anything else was kind of shut out and it was just going to be on the 6th.
Okay. And that was pretty clearly reflected in the content on the site.
Yeah, sure.
On that site, many shared plans and violent threats. Bring handcuffs and wait near the tunnels, wrote one user. A commenter replied, suggesting zip ties instead. One post encouraged others to come with body armor, knuckles, shields, bats, pepper spray, whatever it takes. All of those were used on the 6th. The post concluded, join your local Proud Boys chapter as well. The Donald.win featured discussions of the tunnels beneath the Capitol complex. suggestions for targeting members of Congress, and encouragement to attend this once-in-a-lifetime event. While Trump supporters grew more aggressive online, he continued to rile up his base on Twitter. He said there was overwhelming evidence that the election was the biggest scam in our nation's history. As you can see, the president continued to boost the event, tweeting about it more than a dozen times in the lead up to January the 6th.
January 6th, House Committee member Congressman Jamie Raskin at Tuesday's hearing. We'll be back with more in a minute. Masquerade by Berlin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two live witnesses testified at Tuesday's hearing of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Jason Van Tatenhoff, a former spokesman for Oath Keepers, and Stephen Ayers, a former Trump supporter who pleaded guilty last week for illegally entering the Capitol January 6th. Congressmember Jamie Raskin questioned Jason Van Tatenhoff first.
In the run-up to January 6th, Stuart Rhodes publicly implored President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, the 1807 law that allows the president to call up militias to put down a rebellion against the United States. And I want to get your thoughts about this in the context of your prior relationship with Stuart Rhodes. I understand that you had conversations with Rhodes about the Insurrection Act. Why was he so fixated on that? And what did he think it would enable the Oath Keepers to do?
Well, I think it gave him a sense of legitimacy, that it was a path forward to move forward with his goals and agendas. I think we need to quit mincing words and just talk about truths. And what it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there. That would have been good for no one. He was always looking for ways to legitimize what he was doing, whether by wrapping it in the trappings of it's not a militia, it's a community preparedness team. We're not a militia, we're an educational outreach group. It's a veteran support group. But again, we've got to stop with this dishonesty and the mincing of words and just call things for what they are. You know, he's a militia leader. He had these grand visions of being a paramilitary leader. And the Insurrection Act would have given him a path forward with that. You know, the fact that the president was communicating, whether directly or indirectly, messaging, you know, kind of that gave him the nod. And all I can do is thank the gods that things did not go any worse that day.
What did the Oath Keepers see in President Trump?
They saw a path forward that would have legitimacy. They saw opportunity, I think, in my opinion, to become a paramilitary force, you know?
Last week, the Department of Justice indicated that it has evidence of the Oath Keepers bringing not just firearms, but explosives to Washington ahead of January 6th. And the committee's also learned that Stuart Rhodes stopped to buy weapons on his way to Washington and shipped roughly $7,000 worth of tactical gear to a January 6th rally planner in Virginia before the attack. Did you ever hear Rhodes discuss committing violence against elected political leaders?
Yeah, I mean, that went back from the very beginning of my tenure. One of the first assignments that he brought to me wanting me to do as more of a graphic artist function was to create a deck of cards. You may remember back to the conflict in the Middle East where our own military created a deck of cards, which was a who's who of kind of the key players on the other side that they wanted to take out. And Stuart was very intrigued by that notion and influenced by it, I think. And he wanted me to create a deck of cards that would include different politicians, judges, including up to Hillary Clinton as the Queen of Hearts. This is a project that I refused to do. But from the very start, we saw that. There was always the push for military training, including there were courses in that community that went over explosives training. So, yeah, this all falls in line.
Mr. Van Tatenhoff, you say in your very thoughtful written testimony that we received today that you fear what the next election cycle will bring. And you also say that we have been exceedingly lucky in that we have not seen more bloodshed so far. I wonder if you would elaborate on those two statements.
I think as far as the luck goes, we've had the potential from Bundy Ranch on. I mean, being boots on the ground at these standoffs, and they were standoffs where there were firearms pointed across lines at federal law enforcement agencies, you know, whatever it may be with that particular standoff. But I think we've gotten exceedingly lucky that more bloodshed did not happen because the potential has been there from the start. And we got very lucky that the loss of life was, and as tragic as it is, that we saw on January 6th, the potential was so much more. Again, all we have to look at is the iconic images of that day with the gallows set up for Mike Pence, for the Vice President of the United States. You know, and I do fear for this next election cycle because who knows what that might bring. If a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage to whip up a civil war amongst his followers using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact, what else is he going to do if he gets elected again? All bets are off at that point. And that's a scary notion. I have three daughters. I have a granddaughter. And I fear for the world that they will inherit if we do not start holding these people to account.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Van Tatenhoff. Mr. Ayers, I first want to ask you about what finally caused you to leave on January the 6th? We know that the medieval-style combat with our police, the occupation of the building, this was going on for several hours until the president issued at 4:17 a tweet, I believe, that included a video telling people to go home. Did you see that, and did that have any effect on what you were doing?
Well, when we were there, as soon as that come out, everybody started talking about it, and it seemed like it started to disperse, you know, some of the crowd. Obviously, you know, once we got back to the hotel room, we seen that it was still going on, but it definitely dispersed a lot of the crowd.
And did you leave at that point?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we left.
So, in other words, that was the key moment when you decided to leave, when President Trump told people to go home.
Yeah, we left right when that come out.
You were not a member of an organized group like the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys, as most of the crowd wasn't. I wonder, on January 6th, was it your view that these far-right groups like the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and Three Percenters and others were on your side? Did you have any reservations about marching with them and rallying with them?
Well, I definitely didn't have a problem, you know. I was probably following them online myself, you know, I thought, you know, hey, they're on our team, good. That's how I kind of looked at it at the time, you know, like I didn't have a problem with it. I thought it was a good thing.
I'm interested in hearing about what's happened to you since the events of January 6th. You told the vice chair that you no longer believe Trump's big lie about the election, but that's what brought you originally to Washington. Looking back on it now, how do you reflect on the role that you played in the crowd that day and what is going on in your life?
Basically, you know, I lost my job. Since this all happened, you know, pretty much sold my house. So everything that happened with the charges, you know, thank God, a lot of them did get dismissed because I was just holding my phone, but at the same time, I was there. So, I mean, it definitely changed my life, you know, and not for the good, definitely not for the, you know, for the better. That's all I could say.
President Trump is still promoting the big lie about the election. How does that make you feel?
It makes me mad because I was hanging on every word he was saying. Everything he was putting out, I was following it. I mean, if I was doing it, hundreds of thousands or millions of other people are doing it, or maybe even still doing it. It's like he just said about that. You know, you got people still following and doing that. Who knows what the next election could come out? You know, could end up being down the same path we are right now. I mean, just don't know.
Mr. Ayers, I see that your wife has joined you today, and welcome to Washington. We know this has been very difficult on you both and your family. What lessons, finally, do you want the American people to learn from the way you and your family have suffered as a result of these events?
Biggest thing is I consider myself a family man and I love my country. And I don't think any one man is bigger than either one of those. I think that's what needs to be taken. You know, people dive into the politics, and for me, I felt like I had, like horse blinders on. I was locked in the whole time. Biggest thing for me is take the blinders off. Make sure you step back and see what's going on before it's too late.
Former Trump supporter Stephen Ayers and former Oath Keepers spokesperson Jason Van Tatenhoff, questioned by Congressmember Jamie Raskin. And this is Vice Chair Liz Cheney in her closing remarks.
You will hear that Donald Trump never picked up the phone that day to order his administration to help. This is not ambiguous. He did not call the military. His Secretary of Defense received no order. He did not call his Attorney General. He did not talk to the Department of Homeland Security. Mike Pence did all of those things. Donald Trump did not. We will walk through the events of January 6th next week, minute by minute. And one more item. After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation, a witness you have not yet seen in these hearings. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us. And this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney, Vice Chair of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. The next public hearing is next week, Thursday, July 21st. Democracy Now! Will live stream it at democracynow.org, as we have all the public hearings, and you can go to all of them at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to Karl Marxer. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, and Noreen Sheikh Maria Torres. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
Take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
You're listening to Away with Words, the show about language and how we use it. I'm Grant Barrett.
And I'm Martha Barnett. On the Away with Words Facebook group, a recent thread had me laughing out loud. Member Kathy Bird started it with a post that said simply, "Episodes, the Greek god of continuing stories. Keep it going." And I thought, what? Yeah, I finally figured out that she was mispronouncing episodes as episodes.
Episodes, there we go.
You know, putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable. And a lot of people chimed in, and pretty soon we had this whole pantheon of mispronounced English words that sound like Greek gods. Stephen Fessler wrote, "Lemonides, the god of cool refreshment."
Said lemonades.
Yeah. And Craig O'Connor said, "Particles, the god of little bits that get missed by the vacuum."
Particles.
And I like this one from Jay Banks. He said, "Ankles, the god of podiatry."
Oh, that's good. Ankles, ankles. Yeah, I love that.
And then Christine Porter suggested the god of impediments. Can you guess what that one is?
The god of obstacles?
Yes. Or obstacles.
Obstacles. We had a great quiz from John Chinesky on this very topic, turning everyday words into Greek names. We'll link to that on our waywardradio.org website. We also welcome right now your calls, 877-929-9673, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, or email us words at waywardradio.org or talk to us on Twitter at WAYWORD. Hello, you have a way with words.
My name's Rebecca and I'm from Concord, North Carolina, and I'm calling about the word deplane.
You're calling about the word deplane? Are you a flight attendant?
Exactly. And I've been using this word and it just creates friction in my ears when I say it because it just doesn't seem as polished as some of the other words that we use on the plane, and we end up using it as a catch-all for the process of exiting the aircraft. But it just seems so strange because the word deplane itself does not actually denote what we're doing. We're not disembarking, we're deplaning. It's a strange combination of usages.
So deplane doesn't equal disembark?
Well, I think it would, but is it in the same way that deforest? You know, when you deforest, you rid of the forest. When you deplane, you don't rid of the plane.
Well, you kind rid of the passengers.
Toss the plane away.
Rebecca, when you're talking to the crew or to your passengers, how do you use the word deplane?
We'd say as soon as everyone deplanes, we'll grab a cup of coffee.
Hmm. Okay, so you're talking to your colleagues then.
We would. It's amongst ourselves, and we do use this word with the public, but with so many languages coming on board and so many backgrounds, we just use this word to encompass that process, and it just doesn't seem to be the most beautiful word that we could choose, but it is effective, it is efficient, it just doesn't seem very polished.
Effective and efficient. Yeah, I think you've keyed in on probably why that gets used. So you talk about deplaning with the passengers. You say as soon as we deplane, you can do this or that.
Exactly. So it's something like, you know, if there's weather and all of a sudden we're not going anywhere, well, everyone grab your belongings, we'll deplane and we'll figure out another solution. And just that process of gathering and exiting –